From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The uneasy alliance between progressives and liberals to elect Joe Biden in order to defeat Donald Trump is already fraying. Barely has Biden been declared president-elect when he appears ready to push progressives out the door with his announcements of numerous problematic figures for key cabinet positions. Rahm Emanuel, former Obama White House chief of staff and Chicago mayor, is a strong contender for transportation secretary in a Biden administration. But Emanuel is notorious for pushing a center-right agenda on issues of criminal justice, climate, public education, healthcare, and more. My guest is Richard R.J. Eskow, host of The Zero Hour, a weekly TV and radio program, senior advisor for health and economic justice at Social Security Works. He recently published an article with Sean McAleewee called How a Rahm Emanuel Appointment Would Hurt Biden and the Democrats. Welcome to the program, Richard.
Thank you. It's good to be here, Sonali. Thank you for having me.
Now, Emanuel seems to be symbolic of many such problematic appointments, among them Neera Tandon as head of the Office of Management and Budget, who actually faces a lot more opposition from Republicans than even, Democrats. Certainly, progressives are unhappy with her. And there's numerous other figures that have already been named or are being touted that are not on progressives' wish list. Let's talk about Emanuel in particular. He was someone who is, for people in Chicago, he is absolutely notorious. Why do you think he would be a disaster for Biden to name as transportation secretary, or for that matter, anywhere in the cabinet?
Well, let's start with this. A lot of people here in Washington, I think best to say, maybe nicest way to say it, may be indifferent to the views of the left. Emanuel would be disastrous for the Biden administration and for the Democratic Party. So my advice, should it be asked, to the Democratic Party and to the Biden transition team would be, okay, even if you don't care how progressives feel about a Rahm Emanuel appointment, they're talking about Secretary of Transportation as a strong possibility, for example, even if that's not of concern to you, and it should be, because the progressive base consistently is what allows the Democrats to win elections. Even if you set that aside, the views and the actions taken by Rahm Emanuel throughout his career stand pretty much in diametric opposition to what a majority of all voters stand for and support, in many cases, including a majority or plurality of Republican voters. So it's not just that a Rahm Emanuel is to the right of the squad or people who think perhaps like you and I do. He's to the right of most voters. It shows up in his record. It would show up in his decision making, and it would not only cause policy harm to the country, it would cause political harm to the Biden White House and to the Democratic Party.
You point out in your piece that his record on policing and justice when he was mayor of Chicago is one of the worst aspects of his record. Some of this reminds me of what the current mayor of Los Angeles, Eric Garcetti, is facing. Garcetti, who, you know, is a self-proclaimed liberal, has overseen a continuation of Los Angeles's police department's murderous spree. And he is also being touted as a potential Biden appointee. Black Lives Matter Los Angeles has been outside his home every day demanding that Garcetti be blocked. The issues of racial justice and policing and racist policing have exploded, particularly earlier this year, into the national consciousness. Remind us what Rahm Emanuel's record in Chicago has been on that issue.
It's been horrifying. First and foremost, I think in a lot of people's minds, is the police murder of 14-year-old Laquan McDonald, which occurred during Emanuel's first term in office. And I'm tempted to say that Rahm Emanuel was a kind of accessory after the fact in the murder of Laquan McDonald. For an entire year, he suppressed the police video of that killing, video that when it was finally released, after, might I add, after Rahm was safely reelected as mayor, when that video was finally released, it led to a murder conviction, second-degree murder, for the police officer who pulled the trigger. But he held back on that information, which was not only the suppression of something vitally important in the pursuit of murder charges, it was also a form of psychological torture on Laquan's family and friends to keep this hidden from them for so long. It's just absolutely horrifying. So that's number one. And I think also it's important to remember that there were very detailed reports of what was described at various points as a black site or Gitmo in the Midwest or whatever you want to call it, that the Chicago police would actually arrest people, detain them in a secret location not known to the public, make sure that their names were not entered into a database of detained people in Chicago so that attorneys and family and so on can find out where they are and represent them or at least know what's going on. And this went on well into Emanuel's tenure as mayor. I mean, there are other issues with policing in Emanuel too, but this is not certainly a BLM issue, and we all owe them that movement a debt of gratitude for bringing these issues to our attention. But 3 out of 4 Republican voters, believe that the police need to provide more information, more transparency, and more disclosure. And Rahm Emanuel's record is one of the exact opposite. It's something that, should it become known to the public at large, more known, will horrify them.
Before he became mayor of Chicago, he was the White House chief of staff to President Obama. And of course, Obama, a Chicagoan, had a long relationship with Emanuel. Is that the connection that Biden is drawing on to bring potentially Rahm Emanuel back into the White House?
I wouldn't think so. I think that Biden, you know, having been in public office for nearly 50 years, he has his cadre, he has his people. But all of this is negotiated. And at first, when I started hearing Rahm Emanuel's name, I thought, well, there's one person I'm sure who's floating Rahm Emanuel's name, and that's Rahm Emanuel. But you do.
He wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal giving Biden advice on how to break through a deadlocked Senate. And that, if that was, an ask for a job, if that wasn't one, I don't know what is.
Yeah, and absolutely. But also, you know, transitions, what typically happens, and the left has got to, you know, get in this game, I think, more. But what typically happens is that there are different interest groups, power groups within the party, moneyed interests, political centers of power. Obama is certainly a massive center of political power in the Democratic Party right now. So he may be saying, look, give Rahm something. That's always possible. But let us not forget that Rahm is very, very tight with Wall Street, which he raised a lot of money for the Democrats from Wall Street. They returned the favor when he left the Obama White House, and he was somehow able to make $18.5 million in a year and a half with his Wall Street connections. I can't help it if I'm lucky, as Bob Dylan once said. Then went back into public life. But it's also, in my mind, at least very possible that Wall Street is saying, Rahm's been good to us. We were good to you, Joe. Now you do this for us. So I don't know that. That's speculation, but it's possible.
Right. So this brings us to the broader question, and you alluded to it earlier, that progressives should get into the game on this issue. There was massive grassroots pressure to join into an alliance with liberals to help defeat Trump and install Biden into the White House, even though, of course, Biden is by no means a progressive's dream come true. But he, of course, was the only option that people were left with who opposed Trump. And Biden may owe his election to not just progressives, but also anti-Trump Republicans, and of course, the stalwarts of the Democratic Party who would vote for a Democrat no matter whom, in fact, would like to vote for a Clinton-like Democrat, which Biden is. So you might imagine that a President Biden would sort of distribute appointments, perhaps evenly, between progressives and centrist liberals, and maybe even throw a bone or two to a Republican like John Kasich. From what you can tell, has he made any overtures to progressives?
Well, that's a complicated question. I would say I don't even think, to be honest, he knows how to do that. And I think that I've even heard talk that the appointment of Neera Tanden to run the Office of Management and Budget, that was perceived within the transition team as a gift to the left, and that they didn't understand why the left didn't embrace it, because they didn't realize, first of all, that Neera Tanden has had a history of attacking the left very aggressively and in a very personal way on Twitter and so on. Whatever her other gifts may be, she's certainly done that.
And she was a Clinton campaign staffer. I mean,
When I was a Bernie campaign staffer. So, but we didn't take it to the levels, the lower depths that let's say some of Hillary's people did. And that said, in a way, it's going to sound crazy coming from me, it almost is a gift to the left, because the other leading contender was Bruce Reed, who has a long history of working with the billionaire Pete Peterson and the group that the late Peterson funded to cut government spending and decimate government as a positive force in the United States, although he framed it as another kind of concern. So if I had to choose between Neera Tanden and Bruce Reed, I'd choose Neera Tanden any day of the week. So, but in terms of gifts to the left, no, even Bill Clinton did more. You know, it didn't ultimately succeed, but he had Lanny Guinier, he had some other people were not, I'm going way back now in history. I haven't seen anything like that yet in this administration. I see Biden more making nods to the left as it's described in identity politics terms than I do the left as it's described in economic and public policy.
Right. He has an all-female communications team that includes a former Bernie Sanders campaigner, Simone Sanders. But if the PR for Biden's policy agenda is basically just that, PR, and there's nothing else to back it, then we are in trouble. There are some positive signs among White House economic advisors. Heather Boucher is one. She used to be the Economic Policy Institute. A couple of other folks whose names now escape
me. Jared Bernstein.
Jared Bernstein, that's right.
I debated him on Medicare for All once. He had the good grace to admit I at least refuted one of his points. So, and he's a good guy. You know, I mean, these are people who may not feel the way I feel again or the way you feel, but these are intelligent people. Well, certainly on every issue, they may not, but they're intelligent people, they're well-intentioned people. So those are reasonably good decisions, I think.
And Janet Yellen as Treasury Secretary appears to be one that is, well, at least neutral, if not she's not opposed by progressives, nor is she necessarily embraced. So,
yeah, I think she's, you know, all of these things are complicated, right? With Janet Yellen, I mean, the biggest concern I have about her is that she also was on the board of directors of a Pete Peterson funded anti-government spending organization, the Committee for Irresponsible Federal Budget, which I've been reporting on for many years now.
I see.
So I'm not crazy about that. But if we believe, and this is a big hypothetical, if we believe that Biden and some of his people are serious about wanting to get real money out the door, and if they're serious, as some people are saying, they are serious about understanding that Obama underspent in his stimulus after the 2008 Wall Street crisis, and that created, you know, many years of pain, if they're at all serious about that, she's a pretty good person to represent that internationally and to stabilize stock fears and bond markets. So, you know, he certainly could have done much worse. Tim Geithner, for example, Obama's choice. So, and this gets, just briefly, I just also want to say this gets me to, you know, another thing I think we need to do as leftists, which is, number one, we've just spent 6 months being told Biden has the most progressive platform in recent Democratic Party history, which is true. Now we're being told, hey, you elected the moderate. That's what voters wanted. So there's been a little bit of bait and switch. But that said, you know, you go to negotiate the best outcomes you can while building for a broad left movement that can take power. You work for the best outcomes you can with the nominees you get. So if a Janet Yellen will listen to a presentation, if Tony Blinken will look at, if not the morality of supporting the Saudis in Yemen, the cost in prestige, money, arms, alliances, whatever, then, you know, we got to kind of multi-track, I guess. That's the best way I can put it.
Going back to the issue of Biden centering women as a way to paper over problematic policies, we seem to be getting the most hawkish women that he can find on the issue of anything regarding war, foreign policy in the Defense Department. Michelle Flournoy, of course, being floated as the Defense Secretary. We've covered that on our program. Avril Haines as potential Director of National Intelligence. She's a former Deputy CIA Chief from the Obama administration, who oversaw perhaps the worst aspect of Obama's foreign policy, which was the drone program. And so I don't know, is if Biden expects the left to sit down and shut up, because now we have women, we might have women doing the war mongering that men have traditionally done.
Oh, I'll be very candid, Sonali, having lived through past conflicts of this kind, I fully expect that that's the expectation. And I fully expect that any criticism that goes their way will be framed as sexism rather than legitimate policy.
That was the Clinton approach, right? That was Hillary Clinton's line. They oppose me because they hate women, instead of they oppose me because of my links to Wall Street and I'm a warmonger.
Right. I mean, it reminds me, the writer Freddie DeBoer wrote years ago that, for some people, the left will have succeeded when there's perfect gender representation on the committee that decides who will be extrajudicially murdered by a drone next. You know, that's not, you know, that, trust me, I'm sure you agree that many of us will, if this team proposes immoral actions like the ones we've been seeing in the last decade, trust me, many of us will mobilize over that.
It seems as though the left is a little bit wiser. I mean, I'm speaking in very broad strokes, of course. We recall after Obama won, there was a little bit of complacence because it felt like 8 long years of Bush, you know, people were exhausted. And it felt that anything would be an improvement. And there was some complacency. And now there's some regret over that complacency. And there seems to be, especially on issues like climate and policing, where time is running out, where it's long past due for action, that there's less patience from the left to tolerate what Biden may be promising, which is just more of the Obama years or what a Clinton presidency might have brought. How important is it, you think, for the left to make its voice heard now? Some of the appointees that Biden is putting forward, of course, would require Senate approval. So not only does he have to please progressive voters, he does also have to please Republican senators. Some of them, of course, he doesn't. It's just people that he appoints to the White House advisory councils, etc. How important is it for the left to make their voice heard in this moment instead of waiting till January 20th?
Well, I think it's critically important. I mean, there's a reason why I call my show the Zero Hour. It's because we're out of time, as you said, on the climate, on economic inequality is becoming a singularity that, the gravity well, it will eventually become impossible to break it without some form of massive collapse, police violence rates. I mean, we could go down the list. We don't have a lot of time left. But again, we have to think multidimensionally here in the sense that we have to try to get the best nominees we can. Frankly, we weren't ready. We didn't have, I know some people doing some good work, but we didn't have the list of these are the 20 people you must have. I'm more focused on that right now and on laying out the policies that whoever gets in need, that we need to fight for as a movement, than I am. Iram is kind of an, Emmanuel is kind of an exception for me, because they're going to pick a lot of the people they had already decided before the votes were counted. So while I think it's important, particularly in those second and third level positions, to get the right people in, and that's going to be the struggle in the next 3 months, I think it's also important to get ready to make the case and fight if need be for certain policies. And if we've got to go to a Tony Blinken, if we've got to go to a Janet Yellen, if we've got that, just make the best case possible. And if they blow us off, then go to the voters and say, this is what we're concerned about.
Don't you think it's important from a strategic point of view, from a point of view of the long-term health of the Democratic Party, for Biden to make it clear that he is bold, visionary, and clearly fights for progressive policies that are deeply popular? In your article, you cite numerous times a group called Data for Progress, who right. has shown time and again through actual hard numbers that the policies that progressives are demanding are deeply popular. It could only benefit the Democratic Party as a whole to fight tooth and nail on behalf of the American people for popular policies instead of trying to figure out what the Republicans will allow them to do.
Well, I think one, yes, but two, the mainstream politicians have two constituencies, at least. They have the voters and they have the financiers, the campaign donors. And what may appeal to voters, clearly we've seen the second group, the campaign donors, often overwhelm and make the decisions and leave the voters in second place. And then the traditional Democratic Party establishment culture is to chastise the voters for not going along with it. It's the people's fault. It's not their fault. So we need to address that. We need to do it on an ongoing basis. Now, to be fair to Biden, he has said repeatedly he wants to be the most transformative president since FDR. Well, he's got that chance now. He's got the moment where we need at least, I would argue we need a more transformative president than FDR. But certainly if we needed one like that, we need it now. And we're going to need it even more on January 20th, the way things are going. The situation is going to be even worse economically. So look, we'll keep pushing. We'll keep organizing. We'll make it politically unpalatable to push these unpopular positions and to push the media narratives like you do such a great job doing, push the mainstream media narratives that says this kind of centrism that doesn't meet the urgency of the moment is what voters want. We keep hearing that and it's wrong.
And then there's also the issue of how well organized progressives have been or need to be on both appointments and also policy proposals. How do you assess where the left is? It's easier to demand change from the streets than to actually achieve it in the halls of power. And some on the left have been sort of justifiably loath to get deeply involved in electoral politics. It feels compromising, but now we have some examples of success, like some newly elected members of Congress who have been able to shift the debate, who have been able to cast the votes that are needed for progressive policy agendas, who are also very savvy with public speaking and creating opinions and shaping opinions, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Do you think that the left has invested enough in its ability to influence the halls of power when there's a Democrat in office?
Well, No, but we're making progress, I guess I would say, which is progressive. First of all, we've got a squad, depending on how you count, of about 20 people. The Congressional Progressive Caucus has taken a smart strategic turn by paring down its size. It was kind of like, you know, like Hillary said, Clinton said, I'm a progressive who gets things done or whatever, that things that aren't progressive. But so by paring that down and making it a block that can act more in unison, they're shifting power there. We've got, as you say, and as I was, underscoring, a cadre of people there. We have a lot of people outside who are becoming, who are extraordinarily articulate on a range of issues, from racial justice to economic justice to climate change. So we're making progress. We need to take it to the next step. We need to become really, top tier in producing detailed policies, in coming up with the names of people who can carry them out, and making our case forcefully, but collegially wherever possible. And to, it's a complicated question with a lot of sociological and social and tactical overtones. But short version, we're getting better, but we got a lot more work.
And one could argue that there are organizations doing the work. They're just not amplified by the mainstream media as, as the centrists are. You know, you've got the Thomas Friedman's and the Jennifer Rubin's and the Gail Stevens, Gail Collins's, Brett Stevens. These are sort of the liberal media pundits setting the agenda for who Biden should pay attention to. We always come back to, I think you and I, as independent journalists, the importance of independent journalism to amplify what progressives are demanding. On that note, Richard, where can people find out about your program, The Zero Hour?
This is thezerohour.com.
And we'll post a link to that from our website, as well as to the article that you wrote with Sean McAlevey. Thanks so much, Richard.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My guest has been Richard R.J. Eskow. He's host of The Zero Hour, a weekly TV and radio program, and senior advisor for health and economic justice at Social Security Works. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.